This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Welcome to Real Vision Live. I am Ed Harrison for Real Vision, and I have the distinct pleasure of welcoming James Davalos, who's a portfolio manager and research analyst at Horizon Kinetics, for his inaugural Real Vision interview. James, welcome to Real Vision.
Thank you so much for having me. Really excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you as well. And, you know, we spoke a little bit before. You're coming from a research shop that is very value-based. Maybe you can walk us through, since this is your inaugural visit to Real Vision, of what you do and your firm and what your bent is from a investing perspective.
Sure. So Horizon Kinetics is a fundamental bottom-up, I would call us a eclectic value-oriented, mostly equity manager. But one of the things that's differentiated our firm over the years has been our independent thinking, where the partners at the firm have always limited their reliance upon external data sources, and they really want to use source data and original documents and original thinking to then formulate an opinion. And we believe that that's really the best way to arrive at pricing inefficiencies in the markets. So I joined about 15 years ago and have been following a variety of different sectors and themes and investments. And today we have really arrived upon a focus on what we call hard assets, capital light approach to hard assets. And it's really a extension of our bottom-up philosophy and looking through a lot of the other drivers in the markets. And this is what we've arrived upon from a fundamental basis.
Yeah, I want to get into that because I think that is really interesting. But before we go there, let's actually talk about the markets, because I want to get your market view and get a sense of what's going on in the markets and why it is that you've chosen the strategy you have. You talked about value for a second there. Obviously, you're eclectic to a certain degree, so you not necessarily value, but value is doing relatively well, or it has since the reflation trade. You know, once we got to a vaccine, once we got to, you know, right after the U.S. election, there's been an aggressive rotation and cyclicals have taken the leadership. What's your view of where the market is and this rotation into value and how that plays into your investment strategy?
Sure. And I think that brings up a really good point that my colleague, Stephen Bregman, when he was on Real Vision, he brought up our research into indexation. And what is in the value indices, if you will, is really different from what we consider to be value today. And I think that there's a lot of different drivers in the benchmark, in these cyclicals, relative to where you want to be on a secular basis. So I think what's happening today is somewhat of a mean reversion or an inflection point trade. But when you drill down into what's in these value-based indices, the root of the indices is in book value and multiples. But if you were to unpack that a little bit, if something trades at a low book value multiple, chances are there is a low return on assets. And that low return on assets has to be levered up to earn a reasonable return on equity. And given the nature of that business, the capital intensity and the cyclicality, you're going to have a lower earnings multiple. So unpack these indices and you see a lot of financial services today, and they need a steeper yield curve. It's really tough to make money if you're a bank or an insurance company and you have a flat yield curve. So then you drill down into the industrials and some of these other companies, which I agree, they're not going away. But if you look at, it's not 100% blue skies for the airlines, the cruise lines, the hospitality plays. There's been a lot of these really aggressive reopening cyclicals that might have run ahead of themselves, but that's really not what we're focused on. I think it's long overdue given the duration and the growth complex that these type of names get their day. But just because you could argue that the growth complex is extremely overvalued, it doesn't justify bidding up the value to a lower relative or a higher relative value compared to the growth complex.
Yeah. So, I mean, basically what I hear you saying is that when you look at the bottom from a year ago, really, you know, we've had some aggressive asset price inflation. And even though we've gotten a catch up with regard to value, it's not necessarily the place, the kinds of companies that you talked about, industrials, financials, you didn't mention energy, but also energy relative to growth where you want to be.
Yeah, I think that there are niche opportunities within the greater subset of what the market considers to be value. But I think you need to be very selective and pay a lot of attention to the nuances of each business model and how they can navigate the next 3 to 5 years, not just the next 3 to 5 months, where I think a lot of people are playing this as a reopening, reflation trade, and they're not really looking out past maybe the middle of next year. They're looking at the economy reopening, the vaccine levels getting higher, the stimulus checks getting into people's hands, and then these fiscal bills being passed. But this is a much longer game for people that want to compound over 3, 5, 7, 10 year cycles.
Right. And that's interesting. You mentioned the longer term perspective. When you were talking about your intro of what you guys do, you didn't mention time frame in terms of your investing philosophy. What is the time frame that you're looking at for the investments that you're making?
That brings up a really good point where the name of the firm, Horizon Kinetics, and the genesis of the firm name Horizon was that when the founders of the firm created Horizon in 1994, the impetus was we can create a competitive advantage against the street, if you will, by extending our time horizon where we don't need a 1 year catalyst, even a 2 or a 3 year catalyst. But if we do our proper business analysis and then value these businesses appropriately, if we're willing to wait for a catalyst over a 5, 7, 10 year period, that's to our distinct advantage. And then on top of that, when you're able to do that, you have a higher implicit discount rate in the stock where if you see a catalyst, so today there's a catalyst with the reopening and you're seeing the Vegas stocks, the airlines, the cruise lines, the hotels being bid up. But if there's no catalyst, you can buy these at a much higher implied discount rate, similar to, well, a normally functioning yield curve in the bond market. I guess you can't really compare it to the yield curve today.
Yeah. You know, when you talk about this macro environment and looking over that time horizon that you're talking about, which is longer term, and you say, yes, now we're going into hard assets writ large, if you will. What does that mean to you when you think about hard assets? It's different than what it means for everyone else. I think that you have a unique definition. And how are you playing those hard assets?
Sure. So when we look at what is a hard asset, it's a tangible, high quality, finite asset with a fairly stable requisite amount of demand. So think about different parts, different components within energy, base metals, precious metals, land, agriculture, things like that, where they're tangible, finite, and there's a very high base level of demand. But the problem with a lot of these companies or the way to play these assets over a longer period of time is that the business models that they're in tend to be extremely capital intensive. And what I mean by that is they require a tremendous amount of working capital. And they typically have very high levels of debt in order to lever up what might be a high return on assets. So we try to get exposure to these hard asset and inflationary end markets via asset-light business models. And so these types of businesses have a direct or an indirect exposure to these end markets, but absent the capital intensity. So they tend to be extremely scalable and have very high operating margins, which enables you to not only do well when inevitably there's going to be a cyclical trough, but then ultimately compound and thrive throughout the upcycle.
Right. And can you give me an example of some of these companies or the types of plays that you're talking about?
Sure. I think a really great example in the marketplace today are royalty companies. And I'll just simplify it for the purposes of this discussion. There's also streaming companies, and there's a variety of different models within the broad royalty bucket. But it's a very large liquid market in the precious metals arena, a growing market within energy. And then there's some eclectic ones in iron ore and things like that. But basically, the business model is that these companies have a financial interest in the production of a mine or a well, and they have little or no variable expenses as the operator extracts the energy or the ore. So let's just use a mine as an example. If BHP Billiton were to be operating a very large copper mine or iron ore mine, the royalty holder might hold a 5% royalty on all production out of that mine. So the miner is spending hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, to extract that ore, and the royalty holder is simply just cashing checks. And again, as I mentioned, there's different nuances within streaming agreements and royalty agreements, but these tend to be a really powerful compounding mechanism to play these inflationary end markets over full cycles.
You know, when you have said the 5%, that's interesting. What's the incentive for, say, BHP Billiton or any other miner to give 5% of their stream of cash flows away to another company?
So it's different between energy and precious metals. So in the energy space, these royalties tend to be a function of land ownership. So imagine you were a ranch holder in Loving County, Texas. You might sign an operating lease with Chevron to drill on your land where they give you an upfront payment. But in addition to that upfront payment, you also stipulate that 20% of all oil produced on your land is going to go to you as the mineral holder and the landowner as part of that lease. Precious metals are a bit different, because it's more of a financing mechanism where if you have a mine that requires a couple hundred million dollars to develop, but you're not in a position where you want to take on balance sheet debt where it has a cash interest burden, it's much more efficient to sign a royalty agreement or a stream. So just in a simplified example, you could get your upfront couple hundred million dollars to finish your mine, but then instead of paying cash interest, which starts accruing day one, you're just giving away incremental production in the future to the royalty holder. So there's two different types. One is a financing mechanism, the other is a function of land ownership, but the business models are very similar when you look at the operating metrics and the attractiveness of these businesses.
You know, the interesting bit about it is when you mentioned full cycle returns, you talked about the trough, because to me, what's interesting about the royalties is that when you look at the cycle, you're getting a relatively stable stream of cash flows. How does that work over the entire cycle for the royalty company versus, say, the underlying company that is more leveraged to the business cycle?
Sure. So I think a great example would be the energy companies, the U.S.-based energy companies in 2020. There's a variety of these companies that do not have any debt and have extremely high operating margins. And there's a few that actually were cash flow and net income profitable through every quarter of 2020. So remember, negative pricing only existed for a day in what was an anomaly in the paper market, not the physical market, but many, many operators across the U.S. were distinctly in negative IRRs for months and months on end. Some were negative IRRs for most of the year. So these companies were extremely profitable through the entire year, where you saw bankruptcies and you saw massive write-downs and you saw negative net income, in some cases for companies, every quarter and the full year. So these businesses, the stocks might have gone down and been volatile in the royalties, but when you look at them from an operational standpoint, it was exceptional. When you look at the gold companies, it's similar, but it's actually even better when there's a down cycle for them, because if you go back to the last gold peak in 2011, a lot of the gold miners were very aggressive in expanding capacity, and gold went from over 1800 and back down and tested 1000. So all of a sudden, they have debt on the balance sheet, they're expanding, and they have mines with higher break evens. A royalty company stock might go down, but you have no debt, and you have this stock that you can use to basically issue to sign tremendous royalty agreements at the bottom of the market when they're stressed and distressed sellers. So the gold companies, the gold streaming companies generally will also remain distinctly in the profit through the bottom of the cycle while investing accretively.
You know, if as an example, you know, for let's say you look at GDX or you look at the spot gold price at a trough, what kind and you compare that to the royalty companies, what kind of return profile differential do you see at the trough?
Sure. So I think full cycle is a better example, and then I'll go to the trough, because mm-hmm. you go back to 2011, you can look at the GDX, you can look at the leading gold royalty company, Franco-Nevada, and then you can look at spot. Spot is down about 7 or 8% over 10 years. So pretty miserable experience if you bought, especially if you're rolling the physical contract and you have the decay and the negative yield of that. If you bought GDX, you're down about 50%. If you bought Franco-Nevada, you're up about 160%. So that shows you a full cycle where you've gone from the previous peak to the trough to where we are today. Personally, I think we've got a lot higher to go. Now, if you were to go to the bottom of the trough when you were actually around 1,000 an ounce, if you want to make a directional binary levered bet where you think gold is going to 5,000, you don't buy the royalty companies. You buy the most speculative, levered, small cap gold company that you can find, where it doesn't even make money at 2,000 an ounce, because it's basically a massive call option on the survival of this company. So that's not really what we're looking to do. We're looking to basically play this over a full cycle and avoid that binary bet where if you're wrong or you're early, you can get knocked out or lose a heck of a lot of money.
Yeah. Tell me then about how that looks in the oil space, like XLE as an example. What does that look like?
Same thing, where if you go back to the 2008, I believe it was July 2008, oil was almost 140 a barrel. So you come full cycle through today and oil is still down over 50% in the spot market. You know, XLE is down around 50%. There have been some dividends along the way, so it's a little bit of a bad measure. But if you bought a royalty company that was still growing in its early stage of growth, such as Texas Pacific, you're up over 10 times your money. And so that's a bit of a unique scenario. And they were very fortunate and wise. They never took on any debt financing, and they have an extremely lean operating structure where at the time, they were printing 90% gross margins. But if you also go off the trough through the high, there's ways to, again, in energy, off the negative print last year through today, you could have bought some of these small cap companies where there's a very high quality operator in Texas and New Mexico, Matador, where it got down to a dollar. And I don't think it was ever a bankruptcy candidate. But now I think it's $22, $25. So you made 25x, but just such a different risk profile to basically be willing to run into that burning house at the bottom of the oil market last year with that E&P versus the royalty co.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Lolly Focus Pops or Lolly Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Yeah, very, very interesting. And, you know, behind that, I would say, is the concept that we're potentially looking at inflation going forward, you know, not just asset price inflation, but actual real inflation, which means that people are thinking about hard assets. Maybe you can walk me through, you know, sort of the macro view that your house has in terms of the fundamental economic environment that we're going to be facing over the medium term, let's call it, you know, the next 6, 12, 24 month time frame.
Sure. It's fairly simple. It's basically that the amount of money supply growth is colliding with a fiscal dominance in central bank policy. The monetary game has been played for 50 years and you're basically at the limit. And there's also political impetus worldwide to shift towards more fiscal dominance. You're seeing it with stimulus checks, and now you're seeing it with infrastructure and different types of spending bills. So if you have this money supply growth, 25, 27% M2 growth since the beginning of the COVID crisis, colliding with this fiscal policy, both the stimulus checks and the spending, and then all of a sudden the United States reopens in full at some point in 2020, there's obviously going to be a big demand component colliding with is a constrained supply side. So going back to these three royalty markets, just again to simplify, we'll use precious metals, energy, and copper as the bellwether base metals. All three of these industries have basically imploded and been restructuring since the prior peak. And now there's a new variable, which is probably going to keep a huge cap on supply even more, which is ESG. So think back to the last copper peak, which was 2005, 2006. You had all of these global majors, Rio Tinto, Anglo American, Glencore, you name it, basically scrambling to add capacity, thinking that the BRICS growth was going to last forever. It didn't. The bottom fell out, and they basically spent 15 years restructuring, selling off assets, and streamlining the base. Same thing with energy. I mean, energy's had some fits and starts since the 2008 peak, but shareholders are basically just saying, divest, get lean, we're not funding growth with no cash flow anymore. And then also gold, going back to 2011, I mentioned, everybody was expanding in 2011 and shareholders got fed up. So you've got this shareholder withdrawal from the market, so they're capital constrained, colliding with ESG. So now even the energy companies are probably most in the crosshairs, rightly or wrongly. The European majors are basically saying, look, we'll extract what we have in the portfolio, but we're not even looking for new discoveries. And then you have US shale, which is kind of the only incremental growth where investors are basically drawing their line in the sand and saying no more. And there's similar dynamics going on in all of these industries. And open an annual report for Rio Tinto. Before they say one thing about the metals market, cash flow, corporate strategy, it's 5 pages on ESG. So even if the world was willing to give these companies money at 0% with infinite duration, the way that the tech companies are getting money, can they, within an ESG lens, even add the capacity that's going to be concomitant with this spending and on the fiscal side? So going back to these fiscal bills, there's a huge carbon-driven spending cycle that's coming. The problem is, not a problem, but a byproduct of that is it's incredibly energy and metals intensive. The amount of energy that is required to extract all of these base metals and rare earths and transport them and refine them. And then you have the call on the copper, the zinc, the nickel, all of these conductive materials. And then obviously you have the rare earths, which are going into the batteries. So we think that there's a really unique situation going on right now where obviously there is going to be a change in demand in the intermediate and long term. But we think that the supply side is going to be constrained in these markets long before you see that shift happen.
Yeah, I don't want to get into the politics of it all, but when you were talking about the extraction, honestly, the first thing that came to my mind is that if it's ESG, how is this even environmentally different than extracting oil, fossil fuels from the ground, because there seems to be a lot of energy being used to get ESG off the ground.
Yeah, I mean, it's an unfortunate consequence is that to get some of these rare earths out of the mound, you're digging up thousands and thousands of tons of earth. And what powers those heavy machinery is typically fossil fuel-based fuels. And then it needs to be transported, which is generally going to be fossil fuel-based, and then refined. And then it goes into these products and then ultimately needs to be disposed of. So the world is taking a step in the right direction, but it needs to be more pragmatic about how it thinks about this. And again, I want to stay as far away from the politics of it as well. But if everybody in the OECD world is doing everything they can to achieve these goals, which I think everybody is collectively in agreement that needs to be pursued, if the non-OECD countries continue burning coal to power their countries and digging up billions of tons of earth to get these materials out of the ground, we all live on the same globe. And you basically can't just have some developed rich countries do it and everybody else just ignore it. So it's a very tricky problem.
Yeah. And, you know, actually, when you talk about rare earths, I think about China and, you know, the fact that they've been in the headlines with a tete-a-tete against Europe, the UK, Canada, US, you name it. There's definitely global tensions that are happening. So definitely something to watch, that whole market. You know, on the macro front, I want to go back to the whole inflation concept, because when you're talking about not just supply constraints, but also fiscal dominance, you're looking at a situation which a lot of people are thinking is going to create inflation. Do you think that has an impact in terms of the fundamentals in gold, precious metals in particular?
I think that anything that is finite and a store of value is going to have utility in the world ahead. And one of the things that I think is somewhat missed in the inflation debate, and there's brilliant people on both sides of this. There's the inflationists, the disinflationists, and the deflationists. But you can come about it through any number of highly technical macro approaches. But one thing that you can't quantify is behavioral finance. And this is something that I've been a student of for many years. And the psychological component of consuming. So let's say you do have this fiscal dominance and you do see median households who start to have more disposable income. That's where the propensity to consume is. It's not a billionaire adding another zero to her net worth, but it's also the psychological component of realizing what is the utility of saving when I'm going into a 10-year U.S. government obligation with a negative real yield. What am I really achieving? Even if it wasn't a negative real yield, what am I really achieving if I was getting 160 basis points gross in the first place? And if you go back to the 60s and 70s, the seeds were sown well before you saw inflation really run away in the 70s, where you had Vietnam War spending, you had Medicare and Medicaid instituted, you had the removal of the gold standard, and then the tipping point was the OPEC embargo, where Main Street, if you will, realized I'm waiting 3 hours in line to fill up my tank, and by the way, it's exponentially higher than what I was paying before all this. And it's like, okay, well, what am I paying for apples? What am I paying for my clothes? What am I paying for all these other things? And I think that a certain component of the world, the wealthy, have already figured this out. And forget financial assets and forget things that are in the markets. Look at what's going on in things that are finite stores of value. So pull up a Christie's auction and look at what people are paying for rare wines and whiskeys and art. Antique cars and things like that it's just booming. And it was booming last year in the middle of the crisis. And so within that context, I think that there is a very large pool of people that see gold as a store of value and silver as well, even though it obviously has its industrial components. But I think structurally, it's going to be very difficult to convince people with every day that passes to simply sit there and hold dollars, checking accounts at 0% interest rates, all the way out to a 10-year treasury at 160.
You know, that whole complex that you're talking about, let's use the term financial repression, it doesn't really sound that good from the average person's perspective. So when you talk about, okay, so maybe we're going to get the median household with a greater propensity to spend, they're going to get out there, they're going to do some spending. But really, when you're engaged in financial repression, you're creating a dynamic where there's this discord, towards desire, if for lack of a better word, redistribution, so that the average wage earner can get more. How does this play out over time? That's my view.
Yeah, I don't think that it's a binary divide where labor wins or capital wins, because let's say we're in the Fed seems to think that there's a range of benign or healthy inflation in the 2% range. And obviously they have a willingness to let it run hot. Who knows how long or how hot, but to the extent that there are fiscal policies and different types of things that can empower labor as opposed to capital, I think it will distinctly benefit people that have been marginalized over the past 10, 20, 30, 40 years. But let's not forget who the biggest beneficiary of inflation is. It's the debtors. And who's the biggest debtor on earth? The United States government. And ultra wealthy people can borrow incredibly cheaply, as can corporations. And if they're paying back fixed rate debt in a devalued or a declining value of base currency, then it's distinctly to their benefit as well. So there is a scenario where both sides can win here, but it's a very fluid, somewhat tricky situation.
Right. So yeah.
That light was on a timer. Sorry about that.
Excellent. That's good. So talk about ESG. There you go. Right there. You guys are doing
your own stuff. Green certified building.
So, when we were speaking earlier in the week about some of the plays that you have in the market, I do remember taking some notes on data companies. When you were talking about ESG, you mentioned data companies, and these are uncorrelated, high-quality businesses. Can you run through that particular investment thesis?
Sure. We look at financial exchanges, which are now basically exchanges and data companies, but then there's also individual data and research companies. So I'll talk about both individually, but think about a financial exchange. It's really nothing more than a supercomputer that is matching buyers and sellers across a wide variety of different types of investment products. So just to use an example, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Their business is mostly trading in rates, interest rate futures, currencies, soft commodities, hard commodities, energy. And imagine in an inflationary world where there's rate volatility and inflation volatility, what that would do to every one of those asset classes. So they make money from volatility and volume. There, to the extent that there's increased volume, to process another $1 trillion in trades, they just need to plug in another server. And on the back end, there's a data business, which is basically related to all of the different types of trading, pricing, and functionality, which is highly recurring in nature. It's almost 100% recurring revenue. And then there's a clearinghouse. So these businesses are asset-light, very high scalability, and have the same indirect exposure to those hard assets that compared to those direct hard asset exposures that we mentioned earlier with the royalties and streaming companies. So we think that there's a variety of scenarios where the entire global exchange complex in the US, the Intercontinental Exchange in Europe, Deutsche Börse, Euronext, the Australian ASX, the Singapore Exchange has some really interesting things going on right now, where these businesses could really thrive given what drives their business in a scenario where it's not necessarily that accommodative to global risk assets, meaning more volatility, higher rates or volatile rates, and higher CPI and PPIs. The other example are the data and research companies, where they have proprietary data, information, and research, which serves these inflationary end markets. So IHS Markit, which right now it's under DOJ review to be acquired by S&P Global, they have hundreds of years in some cases of proprietary data and research, and their verticals are the market business is credit. They have metals and mining and energy, and then they also have all global OEMs in the automotive industry. So to the extent that there is inflation in those end markets, the demand from companies and the demand for that data and research is going to go up incrementally, and the cost to basically provide that is marginal. So we think both of these are really interesting asset-light ways to play an inflationary cycle that aren't commonly appreciated.
You know, the inflation side of things is the underlying factor. Before we go to the comments, because there are some people who have some questions that they want to ask, I wanted to get to the other side. Let's talk about disinflation or a disinflationary, deflationary environment. Say the future is not inflationary, but rather it's disinflationary or even deflationary. How do these particular assets that you're talking about perform, both on the hard asset side and then also on the data side?
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
I think if you look at the past 7 to 10 years, or even let's shorten it up and say 5 to 7, you would think an inflationary tilt to your exposure via hard assets would have been a disaster. I would have guessed if you had something that was tilting towards inflation expectations, you'd have a negative total return over that 5-year period. But if you look at a basket of both the royalty companies, the exchanges, the data companies, and some of the other more asset-light indirect inflation beneficiaries, they've actually compounded at a very healthy double-digit rate over 5-7-year periods. And I think that that is a really important factor, is that these businesses can chug along just fine under the status quo, but they could do phenomenally well under incrementally higher 3, 4, 5% inflation, and even in scenarios where CPI doesn't capture all of the inflation. But in disinflation, I would argue that the past 5 or 7 years has been disinflationary. Deflationary, right. I think you're into a whole new situation altogether. And I can't even wrap my head around what would happen in that type of a world, because all of a sudden you don't have the real cost of debt for all of these global governments and businesses going down. It's actually going up. So people have been saying for years now, don't fight the Fed. And I think that any signs of that, they would basically throw everything that they have at it, because that's a really, really dangerous situation. But to answer the question directly, I think that this portfolio would struggle under legitimate deflation, whereas the upstream capital-intensive businesses might very well be restructured.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I agree with you about the disinflation versus deflation. We've had a disinflationary environment. Deflation, you know, debt deflation in particular, those are pernicious, and that's not something that we've had since basically the 1930s. So that would be an outlier. So James, let me run through some of the questions. I'll use this as an opportunity to tell the viewers that if you have any questions, send them in now, because we're going to run through the rest of the questions, and then we'll call time at the end. A lot of good questions on the underlying businesses here, as well as inflation. But let me start here with Ralph, who has three questions. The first of which is, how does James expect inflation to play out globally? And what he means is Europe, Asia, and the U.S. And he's thinking in particular for developed nations.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point, because if you look at what's happening in Europe right now, it is wildly different from what's happening in the U.S. in terms of things opening, cases declining, vaccination rates. And Europe is structurally in a really difficult situation. I think there's differences within a lot of the Asian economies, but they're arguably doing better than the U.S. So again, I really want to make the differentiation between CPIs and these finite hard assets, where I think it's almost a guarantee that all of these governments are going to be throwing trillions of dollars into different types of fiscal policies that are going to reflate or inflate some of the end markets. But we definitely don't want to make a strong opinion on what CPI is going to be doing, especially given the nuances of Europe and within the full global context.
Here's a second question from Ralph. He asked, how would David consider buying, or actually he says, would David consider buying a real estate to profit off the depreciation of the mortgage just for this purpose?
I think that on a one-off basis, if you're a wealthy investor, like Real Vision's friend Hugh Hendry, where he's borrowing at next to nothing to buy mansions in finite islands in the Caribbean, that's great. But actually, we play a little bit different asset light because it's tough to scale. And obviously, he's in a unique situation down there. But think about something like Brookfield Asset Management, where granted, they have some capital invested alongside you, but they're effectively the GP on hundreds of billions of dollars of real estate and global listed infrastructure, some of which is renewable. And rather than being in that capital-intensive business where you're levered up in a property or a project where cap rates have been compressed so low, I'd much rather be sitting there at the GP level with Bruce Flatt at Brookfield, clipping those fees. And to the extent that they can basically benefit from that dynamic, I feel like that's a really interesting asset-light way to do it.
Right. Yeah. Again, asset light. I do like how that permeates what you're talking about, is that you don't necessarily want the assets, but the cash flow stream associated with those assets, and not having the CapEx associated with owning the actual assets itself as much as possible. I think I said David in there. I really meant James. Well, here's the third question from Ralph. He asks, what are the best ways for young people to profit off the inflation other than investing in one's education?
Oh, well, I certainly would not want to do I would not want anything to do with the fixed income world. I think that some of these asset light inflation beneficiaries are really interesting. And I think that they can refer to other events that Real Vision might have had in the not too distant past to look at other stores of value that might do well in the event that we were to have high inflation.
Yeah, I don't know if we want to get into this. You know that we're doing the crypto gathering, right?
Yeah,
now,
that's what I'm saying.
So you just tripped the magic word there when you talk about other stores of value. When you talk about other stores of value, what are you talking about exactly?
I think that everyone owes it to themselves to have a very long and hard look at the potential of blockchain and different related tokens. It's easy to dismiss and it's easy to just, castigate people. But I'll tell you a quick story. The first time Bitcoin reached 1,000 before it collapsed, I was at a wedding and somebody at the table was talking about blockchain, and I just completely dismissed it. I went up and changed tables and just like, what is this guy talking about? And then our CIO starts talking about it. I was like, wow. And then I actually looked back. I was like, wow, this guy actually works for somebody who really knows what they're talking about in terms of crypto, and someone I respect a lot. And I did myself the service of actually learning about it. And I think that everyone should learn about what these types of technologies can do in terms of a store of value. And if you come out with a conclusion that you want nothing to do with it, then you've done your diligence and you've reached your conclusion on your own.
Great, yeah, I think that is good advice, and maybe that's it for crypto in this conversation. But Very well said, James. I appreciate that. Here's another question for you. It's from CB. CB asks this, why do you hold so many exchange stocks in your portfolio?
I think that the exchange business model is just so incredible and just misunderstood. So if you were to look at the multiples on a lot of these growing technology platforms, just incredible multiples on cash flow. And I think that it's going to be interesting to see in an inflationary world, and there's wage inflation, and then there's pressures on different channels within the consumers and supply chains, can these companies actually maintain, they're promising to grow margins, can they even maintain them? But when you look at the exchanges and the nuances of each one of these end markets, the exchanges benefit so eloquently from a surge in inflation within each one of these regional locations. And they can do it in such a scalable manner that it's just a very unique business. But the market, at least in my opinion, the market views most of these as if they're cyclical, transactional businesses, not these data powerful technology platforms. And so the Intercontinental Exchange, for example, is one of my favorites here in the U.S., where you know they're dominant in Brent and a couple LNG contracts, and they have some interesting futures businesses as well. And I think their acquisition of Ellie Mae was brilliant and what they're going to do with automating mortgages. But you can buy this at a 5% forward free cash flow yield. And if our scenario comes to fruition, this business is going to compound at a very, very high rate of return. And if you look at the other exchanges we hold and look at some of the underlying drivers of what would drive activity within those exchanges, it seems like they're just completely mispriced relative to the quality and the drivers of these businesses.
And, you know, also, I think about it from a Warren Buffett perspective. Maybe you can comment on this. I mean, Warren Buffett's always talking about moats. You can't have better moats than in these businesses, I suspect.
That's a great point, because in cash equity, so you go into the New York Stock Exchange and buy a share of Google. There's no moat in that because the SEC basically deregulated it, where you can trade and settle stock anywhere. But if you go to the Intercontinental Exchange or the Japan Exchange Group and you want to trade one of their bespoke futures contracts, that can only be traded and settled on that exchange and only cleared in that clearinghouse. So that's a very, very powerful moat, and it also promotes pricing power. So those are two really unique characteristics, where there are a couple of nascent exchange businesses that are trying to basically start and create new contracts from scratch. I think it'll be really interesting to see if they are successful, but the moats there are really interesting. And it actually just made me think of another comment from our chairman, Murray Stahl, which is someone asked him recently about a geography, Japan, for example. And I think a lot of people are digging into Japan and they think, wow, it's getting really interesting. And it's been cheap forever. That's not what's interesting. I think what's cheap is you're seeing a shift in the psychology of how people are operating businesses, where they're being a little bit more entrepreneurial. But rather than, unless you have an expertise in stock picking, why not just own the Japan Exchange Group? It's almost better to just own the exchange in the market you're attracted to than trying to, certainly better than buying a passive index that's cap weighted. Or you can try to basically pick the best companies if you believe that you have the ability and the bandwidth to do that. Or you can buy the Japan Exchange Group, which has the Tokyo Stock Exchange, as well as the Osaka Derivatives Exchange, and some really interesting kind of new emerging businesses within both of those.
Yeah, very interesting. I like that play. Let me give you two, James, there are two questions on mining, specifics about mining. The first one is from CB, who asked the last question, who asks, what are the most attractive commodity mining sectors right now? Because supply constraints are different across the metals complex.
That's true. I think that anything that is going, basically all of the conductive metals that are going into these infrastructure, mostly to build out the power grid, that's something that we're really focused on. And you can look at some of the more unique rare earth markets, but the companies tend to be very expensive. And honestly, rare earths aren't that rare. It's just expensive and labor intensive to extract them. So that's kind of what China's competitive advantage was. But I think a really good place to look is Glencore. If you look at all of their verticals, ignore their coal for a minute, which they get castigated for. But guess what? A lot of the world, they're heating their homes and cooking their food based on coal, especially outside of the OECD, but even Germany. You know, Germany basically has two power grids, a renewable grid and a coal grid. So look past their coal for a minute, and they have fantastic reports. And they break down the supply and demand dynamics of copper, of zinc, of nickel, of cobalt, and of vanadium. And I think that all of those areas are really interesting to look at. And I think a sleeper, look at iron ore prices for delivery to China, the 62% Platts contract. The amount of infrastructure that requires steel, and now especially that you're using more of the electric arc furnaces that are much more efficient and can't use kind of the raw steel the way a blast furnace could, that's a really interesting market as well. So I think that within all of those areas, there's a lot of areas that you can to find some really interesting opportunities.
And lithium, what do you think of that space specifically?
I think it's interesting. I think, it's a lot of the companies that are lithium-oriented kind of have this EV halo, so they're very expensive. Obviously, there's differences between each one, but those are a little bit trickier because it's oftentimes they're combined within other businesses, and you know, it's hard to see is exactly what the real battery technology that's going to win is going to be as well, where it doesn't look like the existing batteries, whether they be the brand new batteries that are coming out of EVs worldwide or more fuel cell type batteries. It doesn't appear that the technology that exists today is going to solve anything close to the 2050 standards.
Interesting. Here's another question on mining. This is a second one from Cecil, who's asking about uranium. And we get uranium guys every once in a while. I'm trying to think, Adam Rodman, he's someone who talks about uranium. What's your view on uranium mining?
So nuclear is the most efficient, safest, cleanest technology on Earth. I mean, anyone who wants to go green, first of all, they should say, get everybody off coal and go to combined cycle gas, and if feasible, go to nukes. It's undeniable. And I think the real climate experts tell you this, and people that understand how safe a properly operated nuke facility can be with proper disposal understand this. And so take this within the context of what I just said about my belief on nuclear power. How would I feel if somebody told me that they were building a nuke facility 25 miles from my house? I would not be very happy about it. And I would probably be looking to get out of my house very quickly. And I'm a pragmatist about nuclear power. So I don't know where they're going to build these things, especially in developed nations. But yeah, I think that there's going to be, and there's also new technologies out there for nuclear facilities that aren't 100% reliant on uranium. So it's something that we're watching. There actually is a very small uranium royalty company in Canada that's worth checking out if you have a secular view on the space. But I think that's kind of a somewhat simplistic top-down anecdote.
Yeah, very interesting because, let me put it this way. This popped into my head is you had the independent mining or the independent sector in oil. Okay, so we had the EMPs and we also had the refiners. Now, with the refiners, the interesting bit, the way that I understand it, is that they came up because basically the majors weren't interested in refining because that's not where the money was, and they could source sour, heavy crude. You know, take the existing complexes, make them more complex, and then have a greater profit as a result of that differential in terms of their crack spread. That is something that's been happening over a 20-year time horizon now. Is that, and I caveat this by saying, here's where uranium comes in. No U.S. refiner has been built, a new refiner has been built in the United States in years. Why? Exactly the same thing that you just said about uranium. No one wants a refinery in their backyard. So is it possible that we could see something where there's some sort of renewable way to deal with the existing infrastructure for existing power plants that are nuclear power plants, that something comes up in that regard?
I would certainly hope so. And I think that one of the things that I believe in is the innovation of mankind and American innovation as well. And I think that time and time again, we've come up with really interesting solutions, but there's also, you also have to look at physics and chemistry and science and the efficiency of fossil fuels, which can be very clean in terms of gas. Gas is just such an obvious solution, especially if you can do it cleanly and extract it cleanly. In the U.S., we have tremendous amount of liquefaction and export facilities where that just, it's such an obvious link towards getting going, taking a step in the right direction. And also with nuclear, I think that in the right situations and where it can be done without public outcry, I think that makes a lot of sense too. But a pragmatic approach to all of these problems is probably how, what best serves everybody.
Yeah, let me go back to this fiscal dominance and the spending side of things, because Patrick is asking this question, James. He asks, how does Biden's tax proposal slash potential tax increases play into Horizon Kinetics thinking? Does Horizon view tax increases as a threat to stocks? And I would say actually to your specific portfolio.
I think that it would be a marginal difference, especially if at the corporate level, you saw kind of a bump when we lowered the tax rate, but you know, all else equal, it shouldn't have necessarily changed the multiple. I don't think the multiple is necessarily going to contract if you see something higher at the corporate level. I think households are a little bit trickier, where a progressive tax, again, I mentioned that the propensity to spend sits within the median and around the median household. So the ultra wealthy getting taxed more, I think it's just going to result in more and more people where the amount of people leaving New York right now to set up shop in Florida is crazy. And the amount of people that we've even seen leave the U.S. altogether to go to places like Puerto Rico for tax jurisdiction. So I think that they're going to have to be very careful about not alienating the people and the businesses that are really the lifeblood. But ultimately, I think that the secular tides are going to basically overwhelm any types of taxation that might be prohibitive of rising prices and activity.
Yeah, you know, it's funny when your lights go out. It reminded me of a story that, or part of my life where I lived in Europe, and they had all of these motion sensors. One of them was like in the bathroom. So if you're in the bathroom for more than say 3 minutes, basically the lights go out and you know, like jump up and jump around and go back on. So it's very funny to see that. So we have two more questions here still, James. We're almost at the hour. I'd like to go for an hour. If anyone wants to ask any more questions, this is the last call. Dwayne Pettis asks this for you. How will the value versus growth trade be affected by inflation, given that value stocks tend to have higher debt levels?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. But I think ultimately, you have some things that are working in the favor of value in the form of debt, because especially if it's long duration fixed rate debt, you're paying back your debt in a cheaper currency. So you basically have a much lower interest burden. Now, obviously, there's going to be a time when you have to refi and those considerations have to be thought of. And then also you have to also think about what is your cost structure going to look like. But I think it's a lot better on that side of the equation than growth, because under inflation, growth stocks are the ultimate duration asset. They have far more duration than the 30-year bond, especially companies that have zero or little free cash flow to discount today. So basically, if you're saying, hey, I'll break even in 5-10 years, basically all of your valuation is in the terminal value. And so even a fractional change in that terminal value discount rate can change your present value dramatically. And I think that that rate sensitivity, you're starting to see it year to date, where look at what's happened to these high-flying, no-profit, what is it, the Goldman Sachs Unprofitable Tech Index. Take a look at what's happened to that since you saw the 10-year back up to where it's at today. So there is a very real sensitivity, and it's also going to hit the growth stocks in the form of margin compression. Everybody's pricing in, you know, infinite growth and margin expansion. So what happens if growth is curtailed and the margins don't come through? So we're not really tactical investors, but given those variables, I'd much rather be on the value side of things than the growth because of that convexity rate sensitivity of these ultra long duration things on the growth side.
Yeah. And I mean, if you look at the steepening of the yield curve, it's a de facto tightening to a certain degree, which has an impact on the terminal value. I go back to the internet bubble. If you think about the tightening that the Fed was doing then, perhaps when people say there was no trigger for the internet bubble collapse, maybe that was the trigger, that at some level, you know, people threw in the towel. They said, look, you know, the terminal values for these stocks mean, you know, there's no IRR here, that we're never going to go to break even. We need to get out of growth and move to value. And certainly that's what happened when the S&P, you know, there was a rotation into the S&P from the NASDAQ, and eventually the whole thing sort of like collapsed at the end because everything was overvalued.
Yeah, that very well could happen today as well. And I think that my personal theory, this isn't necessarily the view of my firm, has always been that these digital names that were the high flyers during the lockdown, there was going to, ultimately gravity wins. And gravity was going to be discount rate and how much profit you can earn. And the full reopening of the U.S., however you want to define that. But when you can measure economic activity in the U.S. at 90% plus of pre-pandemic levels, personally, I think from a behavioral standpoint, people are going to question all of these work from home, digital forever types of businesses that are trading at these multiples. And that in conjunction with pressure on discount rates and pressure on margins is going to be really tough for, you name it, fad stock of the last 18 months to continue at this pace.
Yeah, agreed. The last question for you here, I'm trying to get the name here. It's Srini. Can James comment on brokerages?
On brokerages?
Yeah, because you were talking about exchanges.
Sure, yeah.
What about brokerages?
Love brokerages. And I think one of the best examples, which is very apropos today with what's happening in the Suez Canal, is shipping brokers. So there's a very interesting shipping broker that's publicly traded in London. And look at Maersk today and look at shipping rates right now, where a year ago, you would have never thought that shipping rates could be where they are, nor utilization rates near 100% in the container space. But you also are tying up billions and billions of dollars in owning and operating these vessels. You have the IMO 2020 fuel standards, which I think still hasn't fully worked its way through the system. You have staffing, you have all of these hurdles, which is why Maersk and its peers trade at very modest EBITDA multiples. But what if you're a shipping broker where you simply earn a margin on A, the higher leasing rates, and then B, the higher volume of leasing? And so, yeah, you'll have to pay a higher commission and maybe hire a broker or two, but it's a wonderful business model. Same thing with insurance. If look at the most recent Marsh McLennan insurance survey on the trajectory and volume of premiums and underwriting. So you have a positive underwriting cycle in terms of volume, as well as the firmest pricing we've seen in 7 to 10 years. Rather, insurance companies are going to have a tough time with a flat yield curve because they have to invest all of that float to basically earn something in excess of their underwriting profit. But if you're a broker and you're simply just earning that spread on volume and premium, it's really the sweet spot to be. And, you know, I'd mentioned that both of these, both the insurance broker and shipping broker, traded pretty reasonable valuations relative to those fundamentals. So love the space.
Excellent. Yes. So James, I mean, great discussion. I learned a lot personally in terms of hard assets and also asset light strategies. So I want to thank you for taking the time to walk us through that and to answer the questions, and hope to have you back on Real Vision soon.
Yeah, this was great. I really enjoyed it. And when I come back, I'll make sure to set my light timer a little bit longer.
Excellent. Well done. Thank you again.
Thanks so much.